Hello and welcome to She's the Doctor, the podcast where we hear from women in medicine about their life and career so far. We'll discuss their interests and achievements, but also explore challenges and failures. I'm your host, Dr. Radhika Thakra, an oversharing houseplant-loving pediatric trainee in London. Every week, I'll be interviewing women from a range of backgrounds in a variety of medical specialties and at different points in their career, each with their own story to tell. Joining us today is Dr. Priyadarshini Marate, an emergency medicine consultant in Oxford. Over the next hour, she openly talks about the three stages of culture shock she experienced when she immigrated from India a decade ago to work in the NHS. We discuss her journey to becoming an emergency medicine consultant, taking the CSER route rather than entering a training program. She tells us about her pioneering work on gender equity and equality in emergency medicine, the importance of POCUS, and her use of the Marvel Universe in the resus room. Hi, Priya. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Hi, Radhika. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I haven't done you enough justice with an introduction, given how much you do. So do you want to tell us a little bit more about yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. So at the moment, I work as consultant in emergency medicine at mostly the John Radcliffe Hospital at Oxford. Mm-hmm. I am an immigrant and I've come to the UK. Oxford was my first job in the UK. And I came here in 2013, having done about 3 years of work in emergency medicine in India. And then since coming here, I've done my FRChem and I've been consultant for about 5 years now. At Oxford, I am the ultrasound lead. So I am responsible to make sure all the machines are okay and everyone's up to date on their training. And I did a POCUS course at Oxford yesterday for our emergency medicine trainees and non-trainees. And I also am very proactive in helping and supporting people who want to get through CSER in emergency medicine at Oxford. I do some other stuff. So I go and speak at conferences. I do workshops. I am on several committees, local, regional, national, and international, mostly to do with gender equity and equality in emergency medicine. Yeah, I'm having fun.
Gosh, you actually sound amazing. Like, it's as a trainee, I'm a pediatric trainee, but to hear the amount of things you do and that you have time for as an A&E consultant is honestly really inspiring. Yeah, I'm just really excited to hear more about all the things that you've been up to and the things that you do in your extra time, I guess, as well as working as an A&E consultant. So you mentioned one of your first lines was that you are an immigrant, and I know you've done some talks on this as well, but I would really love to just know a little bit more about your story moving from India to England, how that whole process was. If you could just share a little bit more about that.
Yes, of course. Being an immigrant was an interesting experience, is an interesting experience. It was 2013, and at that time, I think at Oxford, about six of us were international medical graduates. Oxford emergency department at the time was not very used to non-UK doctors or nurses. I went through the three stages of culture shock. So the first month was really great. And I had, you know, shocks and surprises at pressing a button and the traffic would stop for me to cross the road. And this is important because I come from India and there are no buttons. You just cross the road.
Yep, I know.
And in the emergency department, one of the big things for me was the first name culture. So I had to call very, very senior emergency medicine consultants by their first name. And that we would never do that back in India. It is a sin to do that. But that took me a little while. The humor is also very different. So in India, we have very, it's very colorful and open, I would say, the humor. But the self-deprecating humor in the UK was very different for me to understand. Also, given the culture is very different. And the language, again, is quite different, because in the UK, people tend to speak using a lot of idioms. So for an easy example that comes to mind is, we were handover and someone said, this is a barn door ECG.
Yeah.
And I'm going back into my brain and thinking, okay, I know what is a tombstone ECG, but I don't know what a barn door sign on an ECG is. Or there was something called, when I was seeing a patient with abdominal pain, and the consultant said, oh, this particular symptom is a red herring.
Yeah.
And I quite didn't understand what that meant. Was she saying to me that I hadn't taken a diet history and this is something to do with fish and not? So it was very interesting to learn the language.
Yeah.
I kept being told that the medicine is the same, the practice is different. Mm-hmm. I would beg to differ. I think everything for an immigrant coming across from India is definitely, everything is different about the system. I was new here, so, and I was put into a senior registrar role directly. And to save face, I think the mistake I made was not openly telling people, this is my first shift in the country. This is my first shift in NHS. This is my 10th shift or 20th shift. And the nurses and nurse in charges and consultants expected me to know things beyond my understanding of NHS and the beast that it is. So that took me a little while. It was great in the beginning. And then I went into the winter of that year, which was my second phase of culture shock, which is when you become sad about everything and everything is horrible and nothing makes sense anymore. I lost weight, I lost hair, I didn't have enough vitamin D, I lost all of my confidence. Yeah. I think if I could say when I was back in India, I am the person I am today. So I'm quite confident, I can speak to anyone. Yeah. I was that person. But when I came to the UK, people kept telling me that you need to work on your confidence and you're not assertive enough. And that didn't quite gel or match up or align with the person I know I am. And the assessment that all these senior, amazing Oxford consultants were making about me. So that was quite difficult. It took me about a year to get through into the third stage when I actually started loving emergency medicine. And I think that came because I had the confidence and about the knowledge that I had about NHS. So I have a tradition, personal tradition, that anyone coming as an immigrant into my department, I take them out for a lunch or a meal. That is what I do. And I explain to them that please don't be hard on yourself. Give yourself six months to a year. And if you need to talk to someone who has gone through this, I will understand it. I know you're going to be quite hard on yourself, but don't be. This is a difficult thing. You have left behind your country, your language, humor, food, parents, relatives, friends. You've left behind everything. So don't be hard on yourself is what I would say.
Gosh, you are so lovely. Like, I have the biggest smile on my face. I can't even imagine how hard it must be coming from another country to a new healthcare system, often a second language, or people are often still establishing their English. And then, yeah, like you say, the NHS in itself is so confusing. But at medical school, we go through medical school understanding it and being kind of taught how it weaves into the healthcare. Whereas obviously it's a completely different ballgame for international medical graduates. And I've worked with plenty of IMGs, and I think slowly I have really begun to see all of the other things that they have to go through as they're settling in. And to know that you take them under your wing like that and are such a role model for them is so nice. The thing for me that I would find the hardest is probably like missing my family and missing home all for a career. And then did you ever doubt yourself? Did you ever doubt your decision? Did you ever think, oh, I should just go back? I miss home too much.
Yes, when I was in the depths, in the abyss of my second stage of culture shock, I actually went back and looked for jobs back in India.
Did you?
Yeah, but then I came back and I went when the winter was quite bad, and I came back and it was spring. And then I said, okay, let me give it a few more months and let's see where this goes. And I think I just stayed back after that. I just needed to get out of the state, you know, of culture shock. What helped me stay here was I had come here with a goal, which was an objective, which was I have to secure my FR Chem. I have to become a fellow of the Royal College. Yeah. And that is the goal, that is an objective that I had when I came to the UK. And I thought, all right, now I'm feeling a bit settled down. Let me finish FR Chem and then I can decide after that. It helps to have that goal, that objective in mind. And I think that is what took me through. And I did all of my exams quite quickly afterwards and got my FR Chem very quickly. Yeah, there must be an objective. I know lots of people come across not knowing what or where they want to go to. If their only objective is I need to get out of wherever they are and I want to come and work in the UK, then that is good, but that can be hard. So maybe early on, after they've come back, they can fix their eyes on something that will help them along in the first, you know, first and second and third stage of that culture shock. After that, I think it is medicine after all. We all love medicine. So after that, it was okay for me at least.
You must have been so proud of yourself when you passed all of your exams and became a member of the College of Emergency Medicine.
Yeah, it was my parents were very happy, my friends were very happy, and that's what I came for. So I had my FR Chem within 3 years of coming into the UK, and I did it while I was at Oxford itself. I decided quite early on that I was not going to go into training.
And then going on from that, so yeah, you've just said you decided not to go into training. So what was your reasoning behind deciding to do that? And I know you then took the CESA route. So do you mind telling us a bit more about what made you want to do that and how it went, how you found that route?
Yes, so I think in the UK, everyone is very, very lucky that there is this thing called the CESA route.
Yeah.
And whoever made it happen in the past, God bless them, because, I mean, the happiness I've got through staying on the CESA route, I don't think, sometimes I think trainees who are in a training program sometimes miss out on that. How did I decide I want to do CESA and not get into training? I think the pain that I went through as an immigrant, of going through culture shock, was quite a big factor. I don't think I felt like I needed to go through that every year on year for several years. I didn't think it was useful. I had their experience and I've learned from it, and I've carried on the knowledge and wisdom I've had from that year through, and I've passed it on. I don't think I need to go through that year on year. I think the good clever decision that I made initially before coming to UK was I picked a place that was aligned with who I am. So I take quite a bit of time trying to understand who I am and what I am comfortable with. And I know I don't like cities. I don't like very big cities. I know I don't like moving. I am not someone who likes to own or, you know, drive a car. I like to have my own space. And I knew that training was not going to give me any of that.
Yeah.
So I decided that I needed to be in a teaching hospital. So I picked Oxford. It is a university hospital. It is a major trauma center, both adult and pediatric. And it is going to be a place which is going to allow me to get all of the competencies that I want in one place. So I think that was a very good decision. If I was in another hospital which didn't show me that kind of potential, maybe I would have gone into training and maybe my decisions would have been different. But I could see so much potential in Oxford. It was going to give me everything I wanted. Yeah. So picking CSER was not a difficult decision for me. Additionally, I think, and I just did the math for this, for my upcoming talk at Melbourne, which is every trainee, if I had picked Oxford to go into training, I would have had to spend at least an hour to and back driving wherever I lived, if I decided to live in Oxford. And if I count that up per month and then per year, I count about 24 days that I would spend in driving.
Oh my goodness.
And that is equal to someone's annual leave, a doctor's annual leave.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah, I would have spent that much time driving. But I think I've saved myself an extra annual leave every year by not going into training. And what I did with that was I went to lots and lots of conferences. I did a lot of networking. I have worked on more audits and quips and projects than probably a trainee gets to do. And also, I think because I picked Oxford, I built a relationship with the University of Oxford. I started teaching the medical students there. The ultrasound program that I teach the fifth year medical students now has developed into a very popular course that fifth year medical students take. So I got time to build relationships. I got time to get to know the system. I got time to understand how this particular major trauma center works, make friends at Oxford. And I got extra time, I think. So time and space was the gift of choosing CSER, and I don't regret it at all.
And actually, I just wondered if you wouldn't mind just explaining for any listeners that don't know what CSER is. Would you mind just explaining that for them just so they can give this context?
Of course. CSER is a certificate for eligibility to get onto the specialist register. So the point of anyone doing anything, any kind of training in a particular specialty, is to get on the specialist register of the General Medical Council. That is the end point. That is the objective. And a doctor in the UK can get to that point in two ways. Either they get into training and they get something called a certificate of completion of training. And at the end of it, they get onto the SR, which is specialist register, or they choose not to go into a training program. They don't get a training number. They can still show all of the same, you know, equal competencies and do all of the same work, but not be in a training program and end up on the specialist register. So the point for everyone, the end point is the same. But one can choose to be in a training program or that you can be out of a training program. But that is your personal choice.
And that's actually something I've really learned once I became a doctor, is that everyone has such different routes to becoming a consultant. And the more people I meet, the more I realize that not everyone just starts at ST1 and ends at ST7 or 8 or whatever, and then becomes a consultant. We all take our own journeys. Some people don't go into training. Some people go into training and then take some time out. And it's just really nice to hear how everyone is doing their journey slightly differently to what suits them in their life. And yeah, I guess CSER is something I'm not actually that familiar with because I'm a trainee. So it's really nice to hear about how you've managed it and also the benefits that you've had from it. So staying in the same place, having the extra time, not having to move house. Because as a trainee, as a pediatric trainee, I know my 3 years worth of rotations and I can plan my life a little bit. But there are some specialties where you only know for 1 or 2 years and then you have to move again. So yeah, there are pros and cons to both. And I guess it just depends. You have to look at that and see what works for you. And it seems like this really worked for you, didn't it?
It works for me. Yes, it isn't for everyone, because as it rightly should be, the route to get onto the specialist register, if one isn't in a training program, the checks on that are quite hard to get through. So if one isn't diligent and careful and methodical in their approach to getting onto the specialist register on their own without being in a structured, formatted training program, then it is difficult to achieve that. It was easy for me not to go into training because I knew I could go and get onto the specialist register without being on a training program. But it isn't for everyone. It is not for everyone.
And you had to be, you must have had to have been really proactive and kind of advocate for yourself and put yourself forward for things because you're not in a training program. And I guess at times you might have been competing with trainees as well for the same thing, but you still want to show your competency so that you can then eventually seize it.
Probably not at Oxford as much because it is a major trauma center and there is plenty of work to do for everyone. Yes, but you are right. I think we have to figuring out what projects interest us and then speaking to the consultants and speaking to the people in the department and getting things done. But it, I think it's as a person, one has to be quite organized, get things done and keep on top of it, you know, weekly or monthly or yearly.
So we were talking about earlier how even though you've come from India and you now work here and you're a consultant here, you do a lot to stay in touch with your work in India and kind of have an international presence, especially with your upcoming trip to Australia as well. So how do you do that? How do you manage to keep in touch with Indian medical areas and still continue working here? What sort of things do you do?
So I have not lost touch with people in India. I have great friends and friendships back in, you know, emergency medicine, the emergency medicine world back in India. So I keep in touch. I mean, during the pandemic, it slowed down a bit, but every year that I go back to India, or twice a year or three times a year sometimes, I call ahead all my friends and I say, well, I'm coming over to India for a little while and I might visit Mumbai for a day or Hyderabad for two, and anything I could help with. Do you have any courses planned or do you have anything happening that I could assist with or help with and come and meet your residents? And more often than not, will be a ultrasound course happening or there'll be a trauma course happening or a conference or something else is happening. And then I get to do my bit for my friends back in India. I'll go and teach a course or I'll teach them something about ultrasound. Or most recently, it has all been about gender equity and equality in emergency medicine. Also on some of the social media groups and WhatsApp groups in emergency medicine in India, and contact me, and then I, you know, for problems they might be having on the shop floor or with their management or other politics, and we brainstorm and try and come up with solutions. What I like to do is, one is I still understand a bit of culture in the Indian space, and I have become better at advocating for myself and for my friends and my people. So I think I put together those two skills and I am able to start in some way or the other. So I do help out and I'm in touch all the time.
That's amazing that you spend your annual leave like asking and help in other ways. That's just so lovely to hear. Tired doing that?
Oh, no, I don't get tired. Quite a bit of time. And I think everyone should do this, not just people in medicine, but there is space in your life for it or time in your life for it. Speak to people. There are assessments and tests one can take to try and figure out what is useful for my, you know, one's personality, I suppose, and teaching and, you know, sharing my knowledge and education, and that actually picks me up. It makes me happy. It gives me energy. So asking me to teach or asking me to share or talk is good for me. So yeah. It does not make me tired.
That's so nice. I think I know what you mean. Like, I had a day where I was asked to teach the medical students and I spent the whole afternoon teaching them. And after a few hours, I was like, this is so cool that I've just spent my day. Like, and also it was a working day, so I was being paid to teach medical students. And I just found it really, really lovely that I could, I guess it's similar to what you probably experienced, but pay it forward and give people the knowledge that you once gained from another person, or actually teach them from your own experiences that you didn't learn from another person, which seems like exactly what you do a lot of. I do get what you mean, right? It doesn't make you tired. It kind of energizes you because you're using it. It's almost like a different part of your brain to being on the shop floor, isn't it? So it still kind of counts as annual leave. So you were mentioning about your gender equality work, and that is definitely something I want to talk about. I've seen the sort of things you've been doing, and I would really love to know about more of what you've done from a gender equality perspective. It seems like you've done work for colleagues and for women working in emergency medicine, but then also for patients. So what sort of things have you done, and a bit more about that?
Yeah, of course. I really like talking about this bit of my life. I was in my second year in emergency medicine back in India in Apollo. I was training in Hyderabad, and it was India's national conference in emergency medicine. And there were some resident talks at the time. And I was given an opportunity to speak, I think, for about 10 minutes on any topic that I chose. And at the time, I decided to speak on the challenges of a female resident in emergency medicine. This was 2012 now.
Oh, my gosh.
So I got 10 minutes. And I think the other four speakers, they talked about, you know, clinical cases and toxicology and that sort of thing. And this is what I wanted to talk about. So before, in preparation for it, I did a tiny, you know, research project of sorts, where I called and interviewed about 50 women in emergency medicine, and I asked them what their challenges were and collated them all, and then just spoke about it at the national conference. I think I sort of triggered something that day, and not in the people who were listening, but also in myself. And I understood that this is something that I would like to work on. So continued to do some work there, but then I came to the UK and started off. It was a very small thing that I started off, but decided to put together a group on WhatsApp. And I call it the These Girls Do group.
Nice.
As opposed to Yes We Will or Yes We Can, These Girls Do. And it's a group for emergency medicine, and we mostly talk about each other's issues and challenges and things that we've done, or, you know, I went to speak here, or I got this done, or I got this project or something. So it's just a, you know, we've done this, we've achieved this. That's where it started. 2018, I think, me and my colleagues from India, we put together a course called Gender Equity and Equality in Emergency Medicine. It's a full-day course we sort of created, and it's got workshops, panel discussions, psychometric assessments, lectures, skits that we go through. So it's a whole day thing that you get through. It starts off with a question. Let's find out if you're biased. So everyone takes the Harvard implicit bias test on the gender career one. And although they come into the course saying, maybe I'm not biased, I'm really fair, I'm great with men and women, and I don't see gender at all, you have to first acknowledge the premise of that is, to solve a problem, you have to acknowledge that it exists first.
Yeah.
So all biased, I continue to be biased every day for most decisions that I make in emergency medicine and otherwise. I am gender biased, and I think everyone should acknowledge that first. Only then we can move on. So this course is accredited, and IFEM, the International Federation for Emergency Medicine, we did a course along with them. So that's something that still happens. Recently, we did one for the Philippine College of Emergency Medicine. I'm the secretary for the IFEM Gender-Specific Issues Special Interest Group. So one of the things that we have to do is to identify and locate people who to do similar things in their own countries. So we've identified over the last couple of years quite a few countries where people who are like-minded, like us, want to do the same sort of thing. And we don't want to reinvent the wheel. So whatever anyone from the group does, we share our knowledge, and then that gets implemented in that particular country, in emergency medicine, of course. So that's something. And most recently, I think on the Women in Emergency Medicine Special Interest Group of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine as well. And we are a great bunch. I really like working with these women. Come from such diverse backgrounds. We talk about all kinds of things and we brainstorm, and we're quite passionate, all of us, on the WEMSIG group. So that's been fun as well. Projects am I working on at the moment? I am working on at this point is trying to make space, time, and acceptance better for women who want to express breast milk in the emergency department. And my vision for this particular project is that unless it may be me, it may be my friend, it may be my colleague, unless any woman in emergency medicine is able to put a chest drain in, go for her 20-minute breast expression break, and come back to lead a trauma call, unless there is enough space, time, and acceptance for that to happen, we won't be able to provide mothers and parents returning to work, you know, equality of sorts, whether they're in training or not in training, in emergency medicine. And so that's what I'm working on at the moment. And I'm learning quite a bit on the journey about how people think and what they want and what interests them. So hopefully I should have some news soon on that. Another one that I am planning for the near future is to see if, and I think I know the answer, but I know I shouldn't begin there, is in times of crisis and adversity, like we went through the COVID pandemic, we already have enough evidence to show that we treat female and male patients differently in emergency medicine. And the topic I feel I should address is pain management.
Yeah.
So we already know we are differential when we give treatment to different genders. But what I'm interested to know is when the pandemic was happening and when we are in moments of crisis, do we get better or get worse when there's moments of crisis? And I suppose all of emergency medicine at any point is in the moment of crisis. So does that matter? Does it matter if we are in chaos when we manage pain for patients? So that's another thing that I'm developing.
I just say, listening to you speak about the work that you're doing for gender equity and equality is inspiring. I have had goosebumps throughout that whole conversation, because from a pediatric point of view, I want to take some of the things that you're doing and apply it to other specialties as well. Can we come to your course? Because it sounds so good. Look to see if we have something like it. But I think there's really room for that, because you're right, we all have gender biases. And like you say, especially in times of pressure and stress, we accidentally will fall back to our innate biases without trying to challenge how we should behave or how we ought to behave. And it's just so amazing to hear that you're doing this work, and then to hear about the breastfeeding work. I know that it's such a struggle for women to breastfeed, not only in an emergency medicine setting, but to be a doctor, to be in a hospital, to have just had a baby and be back returning to work, and then to still be needing to express. I know that's hard, and we find it hard enough to go for a wee. Like, feeding is so important, and we should make sure that the culture is there, and as you say, the time and the facilities are there to allow women to do this, because we have such a long way to go for that. I know we do. And I hope that by the time I have children and need to do that, that you're doing will help people like me in the future as well.
I hope so. I mean, simple things like, you know, when we have to wear lead aprons for a trauma call.
Yeah.
Even without having, you know, without being in the position of being a mother who needs to express breast milk, that is quite a difficult thing to wear, the lead apron, when we're doing.
I hadn't even thought of that.
I don't have the experience and I can't imagine how difficult it must be. And for a mother who's returning to work and then not having the confidence to lead a trauma call, on top of that, she has to wear a lead apron, which is causing her more pain.
Yeah.
I don't get that. And the other thing is, I mean, we don't cook our food in the toilet. Our baby's food should not be made in the toilet. Yeah. That is humiliating. It's just wrong. Let's see.
What sort of progress have you made with that so far?
So I've tried to speak up about it. I have spoken about it at various meetings, and I've tried to speak to lots of people in at all levels to find out what the barriers have been or why hasn't anyone thought about it. One of the big things is that I've come across is it is not a problem. So most people don't see it.
No.
Okay, so if you don't see it, then it isn't a problem that you want to work on.
Yeah.
Second one is it may be a problem, but it might be a very, very small problem for one or two people. Mm. That's another answer I've got. And the third one is emergency medicine is breaking apart. And that is what we must all be concentrating on. We don't have the time or the space or the brain space to think about anything else.
Sad to hear. And actually, this is part of that. Like, if a woman can't go to work to express for her baby, how that's going to be part of a reason that she will actually want to leave training and not want to continue or not even training, as I'm learning from you as well, just leaving the career itself. So answering this is part of it.
Yeah, it's good you bring that up because in the leaky pipeline, if we just apply it to emergency medicine in the UK, we have 50-50%, almost more female trainees or, you know, when we are at a registrar level. And then all of a sudden, when we count the numbers for consultants, it is down to 30% or less. Female consultants,
really?
Compared to male consultants. And I can't help but think this is one of the big problems.
Yeah.
Most women in emergency medicine might want to wait until they are a consultant to become pregnant or have children.
Mm.
Not all of them, of course, but by the time that's happened, and then if we don't have enough facilities or support or care or time or protected time and space, for them to be able to do that, then that's a problem, I think, in my head. The numbers don't lie.
No, they don't. And it's just such an important problem that needs to be addressed in all of healthcare. Okay, so I wanted to ask you about what we spoke about before we started recording, which was the Marvel Universe in the recess room that you like to apply to your working day. So please just explain that a bit more for the listeners.
Oh, that's, just a bit of fun that I like to bring to the emergency room. I'm a big Marvel Comics, Marvel Universe fan. So I like to bring some of those things with me into recess or the emergency department. And one of them is when I'm trying to teach someone the concept of zero-point survey. So this is something that Cliff Reid came up with. And we've all heard of the primary survey,
yeah,
which is done when the patient's in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have to do something called a zero-point survey, which is before the patient gets into the emergency room, the team leader or the team must together think about everything that may happen when the patient gets there. So the way I start teaching that off is by telling people to think about what Doctor Strange does when he is trying to figure out how to defeat Thanos on that planet. And while Iron Man and Spider-Man, everyone's trying to, you know, think about, you know, fighting or whatever, Doctor Strange is sitting alone quietly in the corner, and he goes through the 14,106,000 possibilities that
I'm watching this film.
And that is exactly what one must do as a team leader or a team that is expecting a trauma patient to come. So what might happen when the patient gets in? Who might be coming with them? What are my decisions around giving blood or antibiotics, or who's going to do which procedures, and what happens if I allocate duties or certain roles to this person? And then, so there's so many permutation combination one must go through before to execute a great trauma team leadership. So this is something I do. Yesterday on my ultrasound course, when I was teaching everyone the echo and life support, you know, how does one use point of care ultrasound to take care of a patient who is in or around cardiac arrest, so before or after? I actually played a clip from the movie Doctor Strange again. And I showed them the bit where he's injured and he's asking for Christine and stumbles into the emergency room. Christine has an ultrasound machine right there, but she performs the pericardiocentesis blind. So I pause the scene at that point, and then I ask people who are attending my course, and I say, well, that's not what you're going to do. You're going to use the ultrasound machine, because one day Dr. Strange, the keeper of time, is going to come as a patient to your emergency room, and you're not going to make that mistake. And this is how. And that's how I start my talk for echo and life support.
I feel like that scene was made for you. That is amazing. Like Avengers and POCUS and emergency life support all in one scene. That's amazing.
Yeah. Every time a trauma call goes out in my head, it's always Avengers assemble. Every time people walk into the room, I'm thinking, okay, this is a superhero of this specialty, this is a superhero of that specialty. And so it puts me in a good mood, I think. And then I feel like we're a team, yeah, and we're all battling extinction of life. So it's fun. Then I think I can bring a bit of humor and a bit of, you know, self, I suppose, into the resuscitation room. So it's just a bit of fun, yeah.
Know that you're thinking of everyone that enters the room as a superhero.
I hope they do. And it does put me in that sort of mood, because I see them differently then, I think. Yeah,
that is really nice. And I also like how you're talking about bringing a bit of yourself to work, because I think it's just so important to be yourself at work and to let your colleagues know a little bit more about you than just the serious doctor mode. And it helps you work better as a team. It helps you gel. It helps us understand each other's lives a bit more and where we're coming from. And I think, I don't know, how do you feel that's changed as you've gone through your career?
I think we have to sometimes take pause and find out what the other person is like. It is... I can't comment on what happens in other specialties. The emergency room, I think everything is going at quite a high, you know, fast pace.
Yeah.
So even our interactions to know each other are quite fast, and they go away. And there are just moments where you can see someone else and what they're all about. Maybe in the past I had a minute or two to sit down and ask someone what their weekend was like or what they were struggling with. And now I don't have that much time to do that, simply because of how busy everyone is. But I think we should still take those moments. And in my department, and I'm so blessed to be in the department that I am, I am amongst great friends, and they are my work family, and they take care of me, I would say. Yeah, so there are moments, and I really treasure those moments with my work family.
Can I ask you, so you do so many things, and I don't even think we've only just skimmed the surface of the amount of things that you do. How do you do it all? How do you stay organized? Like, do you have any advice for people, someone like me? I like to do things, but I often just get too overwhelmed and then I have to say no, or I leave things very last minute and then I'm just putting pressure on myself to do something quickly. So what kind of strategies do you use?
Also been overwhelmed all the time. I'm still sometimes overwhelmed, and that I think that is the growth journey of all doctors or nurses or anyone who works with healthcare. We all start off with this crazy interest and passion to do lots of things. I was like that. I am still like that sometimes. And that isn't wrong. But as I have grown in my career, I think, again, like I've said, I have spent time to go and speak with mentors and to go and speak with people who are going to say it as it is and who are going to actually give me good feedback about what they think I am and who I am. So knowing oneself and knowing what overwhelms me. So I know lots of people tell me, Priya, you need to slow down. You're doing too much. I don't think I'm doing too much because I pick the things that I want to do. If I can't do something, then I point, a finger and show the way to someone else who is more amazing than I am at that particular thing. So, helping other people and getting everyone together is one way, I suppose, to not overwhelm me. How do I keep on top of it? So I've learned quite a few tricks, I think, from other people. So I have a chart of sorts where on the left-hand side, I write down all the projects that I'm doing. And then I have a timeline and I mark where I am, whether it's beginning or in the process or finished. And I've got that up so I can see it. And then I know how much time I have. I am very careful with my diary, I think. And I've learned this over the last 5 years, more so as a consultant, I think. I will put down time. So if I have to work on a talk, for example, I will put it into my diary and say these 4 hours are for working on the talk. I think I put things in, even if I think I'm just going to be able to do it. So for example, if I'm studying for an exam, I would say these 3 hours are for studying for the exam. So I won't take on more things unless I have time in my diary to do those.
That's so good. Do you use Google Calendar? Because I literally love Google Calendar.
I really love using Google Calendar. And it's great because you can link in other calendars and get information from my Outlook calendar and from my health calendar and my parents' calendars and everyone's calendars. I know what happens. So taking only projects that you have the time for, I think. And another thing is hygiene, I think, on the diary is if you think, when I think I haven't been able to do much for a project that I said yes to, it's important to do hygiene and to clean up your project list very frequently because otherwise you don't have time to do the things that you really want to do. So things that I haven't been able to contribute as much, I have respectfully then given those up and said, I can't do it. Or here is someone who is great at this and please can you give it to this person or project?
I think that's really important because we talk a lot about actually, I think people nowadays are starting to talk more about saying no and not committing to too many things because it's very easy to say yes to everything and then you have too many things going on and you can't give them the right amount of time or effort or energy. But actually the second thing is actually learning to say, I'm sorry, I don't think that I'm able to contribute to this how I thought I would, or I don't have the time, and actually learning to say, I'd like to kind of stop my contribution to this. Even for the other people in the team, it's nice for them to know actually they've accepted their boundaries, chasing you for something that you don't have time to do. So that is a skill in itself, basically learning to say, sorry, I can't do this anymore. Otherwise, you're just stringing people along and wasting other people's time as well. And it's part of a professional courtesy as well, I guess, other than just ghosting them.
A good way to think about it is, how many tabs do you have open in your browser? Because otherwise it just becomes another tab open, another tab open, and you haven't actually gone back to complete any of the tasks that you wanted to.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you was, what advice would you give to Priya? Is that very deep?
No, I like to think deep. What advice would I give to a younger Priya? Think it would be to figure out if, yes, have mentors early on. And I know, I only started to have mentors in the last 3 years. Ones that were formally my mentors, I think. If I had more mentors when I was, you know, younger and I had a formal relationship with them, I think I would have pushed myself even more. So when I mean formal mentorship is this particular mentorship relationship, I think began somewhere in 2018. And there were boundaries for that relationship. There were, you know, we knew what meet, when we were going to meet, how we were going to meet, what were the objectives. We had SMART objectives for me. I had to put a timeline. And I was expected to deliver on things that I said I wanted from this particular mentor. And I know mentorship means different things for different people. Some of it is quite loose and some of it is quite formal. And some of the relationships or mentorships last for different time periods. But the one that's benefited me most was a formal mentorship. And I think if I had to give advice to a younger Priya, I would have said, don't be informal in those relationships, in the mentorship relationship. Because I am someone who likes to have personal structure. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, someone that, you know, going to training is, you know, a structure that someone else has made. Knowing myself more, which is I like to make the structure myself. So when my mentor said, I want you to pick three objectives and they have to be SMART and you have to put deadlines, I think I really enjoyed that because that is how I challenge myself. So if I knew myself a bit more and not like I do today, I would have said yearly mentorship relationships with someone that you approach and have a specific objective in mind.
And how did you find the mentor that you're mentioning now? How did you find them?
At a conference, I was networking and I went up and said hello to this person, and they I went to ask for specific advice. And I don't think this is taught very much in medicine circles, how to get a mentor. Or how to get the mentoring one needs. I went up to this very, very senior person and I said, I had just given a talk on stage, and I went to this person and I said, what did you think of this particular thing that I was talking about?
That's very brave.
And I think this person liked me when I asked for specific advice about a specific thing, because I knew this person knows a lot more than I did, even though I was the one talking on stage. And then after a while, you know, over chai or something, somehow I think the conversation went to, are you having a mentor right now? Do you have a mentor? And then I said, no. And then I was introduced to this concept of formal mentorship. And then that's how it began. It was difficult for me in the beginning, but afterwards, I think I've really enjoyed it.
It's so nice to hear. I feel like I need to do that. I need to find someone in a pediatric world who can do that for me as well, because it sounds like you really gained a lot from it.
I did, yeah. And stick to pediatrics.
That's true.
An easy formula for it is have a minimum of four mentors. Two who are close to you in age and two who are not close to you in age. Two of them have to be in your chosen line of profession and two have to be not in your chosen line of profession, because you do need interesting and new ideas from outside pediatrics.
True.
But then two of them should be from your chosen line. So I think that's a good formula to start off.
I like that.
And please don't stick to one. You can have as many as you want.
Yeah. People who are like rooting for you, I guess, and have your best interests. That's what's so nice about it.
It has to be extremely open and honest.
Yeah.
It is not an easy relationship. I think most people think mentor, you know, being a mentor or being a mentee is easy. It shouldn't be easy. Maybe it is because you're asking for someone to challenge you and, you know, do something different. Growth is difficult, so it should not be easy. I was afraid in the beginning, but in hindsight, I think it helped me a lot.
So what's next for you, Priya? What are you working on right now? What's your next few months looking like?
For the next 2 weeks, I'm going to work on my two talks that I'm going to... I've been invited at the ISEM at Melbourne, and I got my visa today, so I'm really happy.
Wow. That's amazing.
One of them is a shared talk, and I'm going to speak on developing gender equity and equality systems in emergency medicine. And I've been asked to focus on EE in patient care. So that's something I have to speak on. And the other one is training in emergency medicine in my space and at my own pace. That's what I've entitled it. And I've been asked to come and talk about CSER in the UK. So that's what's happening for 2 weeks. And then I'm off to Australia, and then I'll visit family in India before I come back to Oxford. Of course, I'm going to get to meet new people in August. As we get new trainees.
Sounds like a really exciting few weeks coming up, and like a really nice time as well. Thank you so much, Priya, for talking to me. I have enjoyed speaking to you so much. My cheeks are aching from how much I've been smiling. Like, I don't smile this much, honestly. You are so inspiring. It's so nice to hear about all the different things you're doing. I feel like I've left this conversation with loads of ideas, loads of things to think about. And then to hear about your story as an immigrant and working in the NHS and your CSER story, and then also knowing about everything you do to help people who were like you 10 years ago. It's just been really, really lovely. So I'm really grateful for you giving me your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Radhika. Thank you. And all the best. And my hello and namaste to everyone else that you get to talk to on your podcast. All the best for your podcast. Yeah.
Thank you so much.